ready to resume our program. Our next speaker is well known as an authority on eye safety and public education on eclipses. He's a contributor to the NASA Eclipse Bulletins on this topic, and he's going to talk to us about Eclipse Eye Safety Update. Please welcome Rob Chu.
Well, first of all, I'd like to begin by thanking Patrick and Joanne again for organizing this meeting and keeping a spot open for me to talk about this. I thought what I would do is talk on a variety of things and do a little bit of an update on some clinical studies that have been published in the last few years about solar retinopathy in general, some of it connected with eclipses and others not. And then I do want to talk about something that came up after, as a result of a collection of some eye safety gear from Tunisia in 2005, which sort of is a good warning for what we may expect to see in China the next couple of years. And then finish off with addressing something that's been brewing recently about the safety of devices that are used for visual observation in the calcium haline on the sun. So it's a potpourri of things that I wanted to address today. We'll start off by looking at clinical assessment of solar retinopathy. Those of you who have been at previous meetings in this series of conferences will recall I've talked a little bit about how we do assess this and what the main problems are. Generally, just to remind you, our typical eclipse retinopathy patient is a young adult male, the type who says, oh, I can't do that, eh? And goes on from there, and generally is either unaware of the warnings about eye safety or chooses to ignore them, and thus goes out and takes a look at an eclipse during the partial phases with either no protection or proper protection, and of course they end up with eye damage, which doesn't become evident until usually the morning after the eclipse, and things are quite serious. Well, one of the problems that we always have in evaluating clinical presentations of that sort is that people will talk about how they looked at the sun, and we have to decide whether, in fact, they really have eclipse eye damage. And one of the things that we have to worry about is indeed whether what they were using would have allowed them to get damaged in the first place. So we take a look at the spectral transmission of the eye, and as you can see here, these numbers are percentage transmissions, or rather absorptions, as we go through the various layers. And what you will see is that essentially, if we start here with the entire solar spectrum, say at sea level, by the time we get through the cornea here, we've lost the short wavelength portion of the ultraviolet spectrum, which means these are the wave bands from 300 to 315. This is, and below. This is what causes sunburn on the skin and can cause what we call welder's flash or snow blindness on the front of the eye at the superficial layers of the cornea. This all gets blocked off by the front of the eye. As we go down into the longer wave ultraviolet, you can see we're losing more and more of that into the more and more it's getting through into the anterior structures, but most of that gets absorbed fully by the crystalline lens structure. And this is part of nature's natural defense for the back of the eye. The bad part about it is that this will cause some long-term chronic damage, as we call it, which leads to clouding of the lens that we clinically call cataract. It's only when we get down to around 400 nanometers, 4,000 angstroms in astronomical terms, that we start getting light through the eye, more or less unattenuated, to the back of the eye. And what we've done in this drawing is cut the eye through on the horizontal plane like this, through the pupil, so that we're looking at the cross-section of the eye as we get to the center of our field of vision here, what we call the fovea. Now, this little pit here is very important. It's very, very small, but it's where we have the greatest concentration of the cones in the retina, where we get color vision, high resolution vision, and so on. The rest of the retina out here is basically useless to us in daytime and really serves as nothing more than a very sophisticated motion detector. Although there's a bit of area just around the fovea where there's a concentration of rods that allow us to have reasonable night vision, although it is monochrome. You can see that it's at 1400 nanometers or 14,000 angstroms that, in fact, we cut off the radiation getting to the back of the eye. And then anything longer than that now gets absorbed by the anterior structures. So any clinical case presentation really involves a bit of detective work to make sure that, in fact, the individual involved was actually allowing the 400 to 1400 wave band to get to the back of the eye in the first place. And this is why when we start seeing reports of people using sunglasses and so on, that we have to really do a little bit of digging to find out what they actually used on the day in question. Now, having said that, we do know that there are two different ways in which the eye can get fried. We have what's called the photochemical or phototoxic effect, which generally occurs with short wavelengths of light. The threshold is relatively modest at 3 watts per square meter in absolute terms. And this is the kind of injury where you can see here this mild swelling here at the foveal region of the eye. The rest of the eye is unaffected. And, you know, this eye may suffer a fairly high visual loss at the beginning of the course of the healing, but gradually the vision improves. And usually over the course of maybe 6 months or so, this person will eventually recover most, if not all, of their pre-injury vision. More important is if the person has looked at the sun for a very long period of time, over, say, around 10 or 20 minutes of more or less continuous exposure to the solar disk. And in this case, we will get what we call a thermal effect, which is a combination of both the long wave visible, the near-infrared to 1400, as well as the long-term exposure to the short wavelengths of light. And this will cause damage at a different site within the retina, and this will lead to permanent loss. In some cases, as in this example, which many of you have seen before in my talks, this is a case where the young man looked at the sun on a bet to win 20 rupees, and he collected right afterward, which was great because he was legally blind afterward. And in this case, each of those lesions there has a characteristic crescent or gibbous shape, if you will, and we can tell exactly when he looked at the sun just by looking at the shape. So the thing to take away from this is that you'll notice that the threshold dose of energy that's needed to get this kind of thing based on experimentation is about 10,000 times greater than what you need for the blue wavelengths. So the risk with long wavelength exposure is much, much less than with short wavelength. And again, that's something we've known for a very, very long time. This is the kind of injury that we're more afraid of happening, particularly if the person was, say, looking through a telescope eyepiece without protective solar filter in place. And again, that's one of the reasons why we're so concerned about getting rid of, say those old dark glass eyepiece filters that had the annoying habit of cracking at unexpected times if they were used on the sun. Okay, up to this point, we've only really been able to either use clinical photographs like this or ultra microscopic or electron microscopic images to look at damage. This is a normal retinal section in the electron microscope preparation. Here are the what we call the outer segments of the retinal photoreceptors in this experimental animal. And these are normal receptors in an unexposed retina. And if we then put them under the gun, as it were, and take a look at what happens, you can see that both with the cones and the rods, that very nice membrane structure that we see here in these outer segments is quite badly compromised. And if we now look in other parts of the cell and the cell bodies, we can see that there are these granules and so on in there, which are, from a histologist's view, indicative of severe metabolic damage to these things, in addition to the structural damage. The other thing that you can see here is that the rods are much, much more effective than the cones when we whack them with enough light. And again, that's the reason for that is, of course, if we think about the structure of the retina in primates and in humans particularly, the rods are really meant to operate at much, much lower illuminance levels than the cones, and therefore when we hit them with this amount of light, they are going to respond adversely much more than the cones do. Anyway, one of the things that's developed over the years, you know, we've had X-ray computed tomography and so on, and a very similar kind of development has been going on since around 2000 or the late 1990s in terms of using visible light on a variety of tissues. And optical coherence tomography is now making its way into the ophthalmological community, and this allows us to view in vivo structures within the retina that we previously could only look at with either light or electron microscopy. Now, the resolution isn't all that great when you think about it, but in terms of clinical care, this has made a great revolution in our ability to take a look at retinal structures in the living eye, particularly in looking not only at retinal lesions, but also on the effects of glaucoma on the optic nerve and the effects of hypertension and diabetes on the retina itself. And here's an example of a rather old OCT image of the fovea, where you can see that in this particular scan, we've got the white of the eye, the sclera imaged right here, the blood vessel layer, the choroid beneath it, the retinal pigmented epithelium, which carries the nutrients from the choroid into the photoreceptor layer, which is this dark band just immediately above the pigmented epithelium. And then we've got the various neural tissues and the retinal nerve fiber layer, and we can in fact see the vitreoretinal membrane and the thinning of the retina in the fovea. Now, this is at a resolution in this old photograph of about 15 to 17 microns. Or micrometers. And as time has gone on, we've seen this improve. Here's a paper in 2000 with an experimental OCT system at about 10 micrometers. And you can see here that this allows us to, in fact, look at the healing process that occurs within the retina after a solar retinopathy. Now, this is, in fact, a result 2 and 9 days after the solar eclipse in England. And this is a young man who had looked at the eclipse for about 20 minutes of unprotected exposure. At least that's what he told them. And again, one of the things we have to do with these things is be very skeptical sometimes about exactly what the nature of the exposure history happens to be. But in here we can see this hyper-reflective layer in the retinal pigmented epithelium intruding into the overlying photoreceptor layer here. And this represents some degree of fluid accumulation or edema in these tissues as a result of the insult. And you can see here, 9 days after the event, in fact, this is starting to dissipate quite nicely. So the swelling is going down, and in this case, the vision is coming up. And within 9 days, he's gone from 2200, which is legally visually impaired, to 2160, which just puts him over into the borderline of poor vision, but not what we would consider eligible for blindness services and so on. And eventually, if this patient had been followed through to the inevitable conclusion, we'd probably see this completely resolved and his vision coming back up to around 2030 or 2020 and quite satisfactory. Here's another example published in 2004 in the Australian Clinical and Experimental Optometry Journal. Here's a case of solar retinopathy, which looks very much like the sample I showed earlier. And this is a three-month post-exposure view. This is actually a case of psychotropic drugs, recreational type, inducing sun gazing. Not quite LSD, but something similar to that. But in this case, 3 months after the event, what's really nice about this is it shows the site of the damage. 3 months after the event, we've got this void right in the RPE layer. And this is exactly what we would expect in the case of a thermal injury to the retina. So what we're seeing here is with the development of these new diagnostic techniques, we're now able to really take a look in much better contrast to what we used to do to see how the damage occurs, where it occurs, and how it's being repaired. And so over the next few years, as we accumulate more of these case presentations, it's going to be fascinating to see how we can use these tools to really track the progress in this kind of damage. And it still doesn't take away the problem of how we protect the eye, but at least now we've got a better idea of being able to look at the living eye with these tools and maybe get some idea of exactly what the prognosis for recovery of vision is going to be. And that's a very exciting development that I've seen since our last gathering. Moving on to protection, unfortunately, I was going to bring this viewer with me this morning, but I inadvertently left it under the newspapers they gave us at the hotel, and I'm afraid it's probably in the garbage bin by now. But this is a viewer that was collected after the 2005 event in Tunisia. And again, just to review things for those of you who haven't seen this before, we do have various ways in the standards business for eye protection of evaluating eye protectors. And we have all these wonderful formulae, which are really simple compared to what we saw in magnetohydrodynamics yesterday. But nevertheless, with my students, they'll still run screaming out of the room. But that's irrelevant to what we're going to do here. Nevertheless, we can do these calculations for the ultraviolet spectrum. For the for the transmittance, we use luminous transmittance, which takes into account the eye spectral sensitivity so that we can really gauge how bright the world appears through these various types of filters. And we can, again, use the these calculations to work out what that happens to be as a contrast to physical transmittance, which is what we would use in the ultraviolet or indeed in infrared. What we do always put in is these fudge factors, S of lambda, which are spectral sensitivity curves. Again, when we take a look at how the eye is reacting to various types of optical radiation, we know that there are certain wave bands or certain wavelengths that give us maximal response, and we can scale the rest of the wave band according to those effects, and that's what these things do. Now, generally, in occupational safety work, what we do is take a look at a filter and at the radiant output of a source and look at what the overall biological effect of that radiation is on the eye. And we do the similar thing on the for solar exposure. And normally these things are gauged in terms of, say, an 8-hour exposure or a 1-minute exposure or what have you, depending on the industrial or occupational situation. And doing those kinds of things in 1999, I did come up with this technical specification on transmittance, which was used by many of the European standards organizations, for example, British Standards Institution, Standards Institution of France and Germany, Austria, and so on, to certify solar filters, the eclipse glasses, and so on, that were being distributed in Europe. And as you can see here, we've got various criteria for the various wave bands, some of them based on welding filter requirements, some of them based on what we knew was safe for solar exposure from previous experiments. And this basically seems to have evolved into a de facto international standard for transmittance of these eclipse glasses and so on. Well, just to cut to the chase, what we have is a blue plastic lens in an eclipse viewer that was being sold in Tunisia for the partial eclipse that year. And this was manufactured by this optical company in China. Well, I've scanned this thing, so luckily, even if I've lost the original sample, I've got this evidence of what it is. You notice the lens is sort of a bluish color. It's about a 50% blue intensity if you take a look at it. And it's for the Tunisia October eclipse. Notice in French, warning, never look at the sun without special protective lenses in front of your eyes. Watch out for infants, not to be used by children under 3 years of age in the case of eye disease or in the case of ocular eye surgery. CE certified by CCQS UK. Here's the certification number. And then down here, this is not a toy. These glasses, these protective glasses for observing the eclipse conform with, the European directive. Those of you who come from Europe will know this, the European Council directive on protective equipment, personal protective equipment, and then it just goes on to talk about various other weasel words that you have to put in here to satisfy the European regulations. And then, at any rate, the point is it's very well labeled for warnings with those lenses. Well, I did a little bit of digging. The Wenzhou Optical Company is a very large company based in China. It's got a number of divisions. And Yongji Optical, in fact, is their company which produces things like 3D anaglyphic glasses and eclipse glasses. CCQS is a company that the Chinese government actually organized in the UK. And what they do, in fact, is certify products made in China to attest to their conforming to the European Council Directive for personal protective equipment. So somehow they've managed to come up with a safety certification, if you will, for this particular device. Now, the one thing, again, for our, the members of our audience who are in the from Europe, the one thing that you notice from both sides of this device is what's missing for a certified European device?
The label.
The CE mark. So they've used all the language for a device that would bear the CE mark, but there's no real CE mark there. I still haven't been able to figure out what the certification number means or what that signifies in terms of which standard it was certified against. Here's the data on the device. So this really is around, this is physically a 40% transmittance, but if we take into account spectral sensitivity of the eye, it's closer to a 50% luminous transmittance. You notice that it's pretty much only conforming to the ultraviolet B or shortwave ultraviolet requirement for the for a solar viewer in any case. So Lord knows how many of these got sold in Tunisia and how many people actually used it. Unfortunately, Tunisia is not one of those places where we're likely to get any reports from the ophthalmological community on eye damage as a result of the eclipse in 2005. What I have been able to figure out is that, in fact, this blue lens was what they simply use in their blue-red anaglyphic glasses for distribution in newspapers to look at 3D color photographs and so on. We think in conversations with some of my standards colleagues in Europe, we think this may have been a certification as a special purpose sun lens rather than a personal protective device. But really, the question is, how was the certification obtained? What was it, and how did they do it? And this is really a warning about what we can probably expect to see in China in 2008-2009, and possibly in the Pacific region in 2010, that there are these problems with the types of standards that are being used for these devices, how they're being applied. So that's something, again, that we've got to watch out for in our education efforts in dealing with safety questions. Finally, very, very briefly about calcium K-line systems. I noticed Daystar is coming out with a calcium H-line filter. They've already marketed their K-line to compete with Coronado. And again, this is sort of a tempest in a teapot. There are a number of claims that have been floating around on the web about the fact that you need a lot of energy in order to see a see an image that you can actually interpret. That's fair enough. That's perfectly true. The question is it dangerous? There are some people who have that knee-jerk reaction. It's ultraviolet radiation. You're looking at it for extended periods of time. Ipso facto, it's got to be dangerous. Well, let's just take a look at some numbers. We've got fairly good data on how much calcium K-line radiation is coming down from the sun. It may be rather coarse data, but it's still enough that we can do a back-of-the-envelope calculation. So I've used as my source the NASA standard solar irradiance spectrum. Thank you very much, Jay. My brain's gone. Anyway, here we go. NASA's data. We've got the irradiance level at the calcium K line. We've got a nominal bandwidth. I've just, for the sake of argument, used the Coronado PST optical setup and made an arbitrary decision. Let's assume that we've got a 100-second continuous exposure on the sun through this device to look at this and calcium K. The exposure level at the prime focus is this. This is the worst case. If you actually were able to put your eye at the prime focus of the objective in the PST device with behind the blocking filter but without an eyepiece. Of course, you put an eyepiece in there, it's going to spread it out even worse, so even further, and it'll drop the level considerably. We use the standard occupational level of exposure, which is this, to limit what we would be putting in. Yes, it is quite low. So if we take the fraction of this and take the log, that tells us the minimum density we need to protect the eye. 3.46 is what you need. And in fact, if you take a look at the Coronado site, for example, they say their calcium K-line PST has an effective optical density of 5. And I've done measurements on them, and I can corroborate that. So, you know, between 5 and 3.46, we're 1.5 log units below or deeper than the minimum density we need. So there really isn't a hazard there if you're using this system properly. And so I hope that puts paid to the idea that there is a hazard to the eye of viewing the sun through calcium K-line systems. So I think I'm just about out of time, so I will stop there, and thank you for your attention. Other than, I do need some more research funds.
Thank you, Ralph. Do we have any questions? Oh, a bunch. Where do we start? Jay?
Well, a good question. If we're somewhere and we suspect, you know, there's a suspect filter, what should we do? I mean, obviously, some people not to use them, but how can we, is there sort of a rapid way of testing in sight at night?
Now, that's a very good question, and generally, you probably won't have access to the equipment that's going to be needed. You know, my spectrophotometer is one that is an extended-range instrument that is capable of getting down to six absorption units. There is only a handful of those instruments in North America, let alone anywhere else. I think the best thing you can do if you suspect that there is something amiss about a piece of merchandise, you try to find a trading standards office that might be able to enforce the rules. Now, that's more something that we find in Europe, where they have very, very strict compliance mechanisms. In the Far East, it's likely not going to be, well, isn't that too bad? Just try to discourage people from buying that particular product. But that's a real tough issue.
Or use a magnifying glass to see if it burns.
Yeah. Well, it's problematic.
Actually, it'd be useful. It'd be great if we could find some simple, sort of semi-qualitative way of just saying no way, or, you know, I mean, obviously we bring our own, we hand them out, but, you know.
The difficulty is that, you know, and this relates to things like cross-polaroid sunglasses and so on. Well, you get the impression from what you can see that the thing may be very dark. The problem is, what about the infrared, where you really have no way of measuring it, and you know that most pigments that are used in dyeing lens materials are essentially transparent in the infrared. And so the problem is, it may look perfectly safe when in fact it isn't.
Daniel?
Yes, a specific comment here. In this case of the blue filter, it was very obvious that it was not a solar filter. So there was no question about that. And still it was being sold in pharmacies. That's a bizarre thing. So there may be some education necessary in a certain group of vendors, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's... what it tells us is that we've got to think as a community about who we should be talking to. A lot of the time we've really aimed our safety messages at either the medical community or the astronomical community to disseminate the knowledge to their schools. I think we also have to think that the medical community is not the only. We've got to also look at purveyors of sunglasses and pharmacies, as an example, of other routes for distribution, where people have to be aware about the safety of the product.
Actually, there is anecdotal evidence of some medical cases coming out of this, and the only case I've heard about directly is a European tourist who used prosthetic glasses.
Again, that's not surprising, because it's going to be people from more wealthy groups that are likely to seek out the medical attention. A lot of others will just take it as, well, them's the breaks and move on.
Okay, let's take one more question, then we've got to move on. Jen?
I just had one quick question. I don't see any reference to how many of these people who have been injured were using magnification or what kind of intensities they were looking at.
Okay,
is this another cross-reference?
Yeah.
There's a lot of misconception.
Well, yes, that's true. Most of the cases that you see reported in the medical literature really are cases of people who were just using the naked eye or the unaided eye with just the wrong kind of filter. Most eye care clinics, emergency wards, and so on do not keep good records on this kind of thing, and they really don't care. They're just going to be looking to see what the damage is. And even on follow-up, it's very hard for us in the kinds of surveys we do on these kinds of damage to be able to tell if they were really using magnification or otherwise. So it is a problem of getting the details. Anyway, I'll be happy to talk to anybody after lunch or break.
Thank you.